It would have been like asking you to fight alongside the same orcs who had devastated your city and slaughtered its inhabitants the previous orbit. After they had raped your women and children and consumed their bodies before your very eyes.
You may not believe me, but if it meant that as allies we were able to withstand a stronger enemy still, I would do it. There would be opportunities enough later on to destroy the orcs. Alvaro went on relentlessly. Rejalin, you elves don't have any sense of what might be the appropriate time for action. Your turning up here is the best example. Only after a full 5 cycles have passed does it occur to your ruler to want to share his knowledge. 5 cycles! Enough now, said Malon harshly. I offer my apologies for my companion, Your Majesty, he continued, addressing King Nate in measured tones. He is a warrior, longing to return to battle. When there is peace, he does not know what to do with his sword. He stood up. We will withdraw and refresh ourselves with a bath, and then return rested to your presence.
It is forgiven, said Nate.
Rejalin nodded and met Malon's eyes again with her gaze.
I shall have a selection of costumes brought to your chambers.
Malon inclined his head and left the hall with his officer. They walked in silence, not even speaking when they reached their respective rooms. The dispute between Rejalin and Alvaro had spread to the two men. By evening, it was to be settled. Not only was the masked ball about to begin, but the sky had suddenly changed. So when Prince Malon awoke, he found only lowering darkness as far as the eye could see. From the window of his chamber just above the crenellated battlements, he could discern the various shades of grey in the clouds, interspersed with strips of ragged black, racing across with the wind, and curtains of rain falling to the ground to soak the fields of golden sheaf. The wind had picked up noticeably, with the fresh breeze now a gale, undecided about whether it should get stronger still or start to die away. On the horizon lightning flashed, and Malon heard a rumble of distant thunder. There was a knock.
"Excuse me, my prince. We are awaited," called Alvaro from outside the door. "Put on your costume and let us go down."
"I'll be ready soon," Malon replied, looking through the selection of masks King Nate had supplied. At first he could not find anything to suit his mood. He wanted neither to be an airy, fantastical form in blue floating cloth and wire contraptions, nor to represent an oversized ear of barley, nor to wear a robe of gold pieces that would be heavier than his armor. He decided on wearing his own armor instead, and with it a black and white feathered mask studded with rubies. Then he went to open the door, to be met with a surprising vision of Alvaro. He laughed out loud. The officer had forced himself into a gnome costume. The false nose of papier-mâché and a foolish cap with bells on showed how he was having to present himself at the ball.
"There was no choice," he growled. "I'll wager this is King Nate's idea of revenge for the quarrel at table." He looked at his master enviously. "So, what are you supposed to be?"
"I am going as my father. He wore this armor, and I'm about the size he was in the pictures," replied Malon, not able to suppress his grin. "If there's a prize this evening, you can be sure of my vote."
"Too kind, my prince."
Alvaro waited until Malon had started down the corridor, then followed him, a little to one side.
"I wanted to ask you to forgive me," he said at last. "But I couldn't help saying what I did. You know I've got nothing against the elves, but as long as they can't provide any explanation apart from the one you gave to Rejalin, I'm staying on my guard."
"Let it go," said Malon, clapping him on the shoulder. "You are forgiven. Just make sure you don't go on like that again when I'm around. Otherwise you're free to say what you like." He knew that many of the army veterans shared his officer's views. Forbidding them to voice their opinions would only encourage their prejudice against the elves.
"Thank you, my prince," Alvaro bowed.
They reached the stairs down to the ballroom where the guests were assembling. The costumes were brightly coloured, some eccentric, many daring in the extreme. There were animals in the throng as well as imaginary beings, even an orc or two, and an alf were spotted by the visitors from Eidoslain.
"Regalian won't like that,"
grinned Alvaro, pointing to the alf. "Now you're a gnome, the spitefulness suits you. Mind you don't stick like that." They went down the steps, and their arrival was announced. They were met with applause. It was a double honour to be bowing to a hero and to a prince. Malin found himself looking out for Regalian. He caught sight of her near the door, wearing a dress that could only have been woven by elves. It seemed to consist of silver threads and stars. Together with the jewel-studded coronet of plaited hair, her appearance was that of an elf goddess, a constellation of the night sky come to life and wandering now among mortals. Regalian smiled over at him and bowed. For the prince, the world stopped turning. He only had eyes for her. Even when King Nate in the costume of a magus arrived to bid him welcome and stood directly in front of him, Malin's gaze slid round to where the elf maiden was. Nothing could match her immaculate beauty, not the flawless crystal on the tables, the shining gold on the walls, or the wonderful paintings on the ceiling. Apart from her, everything paled into ugly insignificance.
"Prince Malin, can you hear me?"
King Nate tried to get his attention.
"I was telling you that you will be given an opportunity to admire the diamond."
Now he had to tear his eyes away. "What diamond?" he asked distractedly. Then he remembered. "Oh, you mean that diamond?" Nate's eyes smiled knowingly.
"It is the only thing that could compete with Regalian's own faultless beauty."
Malin looked over to her again, but she had slipped from sight among the throng of guests. Disappointment filled him, and he turned to Nate.
"You would show me the stone? Why?"
"Do you fear a danger, Prince Malin?"
the king asked.
"In this hall there are only people that I trust. None here would dare to lay a hand on my possessions."
He raised his right hand, a movement noted on the dais nearby. The soft music died away to be replaced by fanfares calling the attention of all the guests to their royal host. Tabane's ruler mounted the steps to his throne.
"Trusted friends, the winds may rage outside, but we shall not let them affect our welcome for our honoured guest, Prince Malin, ruler of Eidoslain and hero of many battles fought to protect our land, and for whom this celebration ball is held."
The crowd clapped enthusiastically. Nate gestured toward Regalian, who had come to where Malin was standing.
"The people of Alandor likewise have honoured us by sending a wise and dazzling beauty. Regalian is my guest, and is having discussions with me about how our two realms can help each other with the knowledge we have each amassed."
The crowd applauded once more. "Dazzling beauty is usually to distract from some hidden flaw," muttered Alvaro. One of the guests in orc costume turned his head. King Nate sighed to the guards to open the door. As Tabane's anthem sounded, a servant brought out a velvet cushion bearing a diamond. The people held their breath. The stone caught the light from the chandeliers and glowed with cold fire.
"Humans and elves are here assembled, and so I want to complete the circle of peoples by repeating the words of Gandogar Silverbeard, the High King of the Dwarfs, when he handed this gift to me."
Nate cleared his throat.
"Just as this and 13 further stones all resemble each other, may our thoughts henceforth be in harmony and our hearts beat for the benefit of all our lands. If doubts arise within the community of our peoples, let us look at the stone and remember."
He lifted the diamond in both hands and held it above his head.
"Let us remember these words. For Tabane, For Gerdlagard!
Cheers resounded as the assembled guests were swept on a wave of enthusiasm. But Alvaro grimaced. He thought the king's words were aimed at him.
Though it shine never so brightly, said Malin to Rejalin, it is a lifeless thing and cannot match your living beauty.
He held out his hand. Will you do me the honour of taking the floor with me? The elf nodded and laid her left hand on his outstretched palm.
You will have to show me how. I am not familiar with the dance steps humans use.
The prince led her to the middle of the ballroom, oblivious to all else.
Simply follow my lead, Rejalin.
Nate came over to Alvaro, who was furiously watching the spellbound prince.
You will have taken note of my words, Alvaro,
inquired the king, holding out the stone.
Harmony is the order of the day.
The officer bowed.
Certainly, Your Majesty.
He looked at the diamond. But you are aware that only one of the 14 gems is the real diamond, he said so quietly that none of the others could hear. That is the way with false beauty. Many allow themselves to be dazzled by it, he added regretfully, his eyes on the dance floor, while others recognize it for what it is. King Nate closed his fingers over the diamond, his voice angry now.
Alvaro, you are an incorrigible warrior, blinkered and unwilling to recognize goodness even when it is dancing in front of your nose. The costume of a gnome is indeed well suited to you tonight.
Whereas the garb of a magus that you wear is pretentious on your shoulders, retorted Alvaro with anger. I say what I mean. Even to the most powerful in the land.
He tapped himself on the chest.
For I have fought for this land. In the front line, man to man. It is to a blinkered, incorrigible warrior such as myself that you owe your title.
He glanced over at the guest in the Alfar costume.
Excuse me. I will join the other monsters. I have wise phrases, too. It was always mistrust that averted disaster, never trust.
His heart beating fast, Alvaro made his bow, only too well aware of the enormity of the words he had spoken to the ruler. At that moment, the door of the ballroom balcony flew open as a mighty gust of wind blew out most of the candles. Only those in glass lanterns resisted staunchly. A fizzing, crackling object swept through, throwing off sparks and clanking and clattering as it bounced down from step to step. It looked like two hemispherical iron braziers fused together, but in its center there was not burning charcoal, but a strange figure. Stone flags cracked under the weight of the contraption. The dancers pushed each other out of the way in horror, and the guards rushed up with their halberds at the ready to protect the king. The huge metal globe, a cage of strong iron bands each the width of two fingers, crashed through the crowd, mowing down two of the men. There was the sound of breaking bones. The guards were left screaming in agony. In full view of the terrified spectators, the grim object came to a halt. Locks clanked open, and the metal bands folded away, disappearing into a kind of iron sack on the creature's back. What the frightened guests had only vaguely been able to see up to now emerged grinning and baring its teeth. It was as tall and broad as an orc, with shimmering grey skin streaked with black and dark green. The creature's face had a terrifying grace and symmetry that the humans here had heard of in tales of quite another people. The Alfar. Sharp ears protruded through the long black hair, and as it drew its mighty sword, it opened its mouth in a roar, revealing a powerful set of pointed teeth.
Stay back!
Malin pushed Rejalin aside and ran over to the king. There was no doubt in his mind that the creature wanted the diamond. The diamond! He raced to the head of the line of guards who stood in front of their ruler with lowered spear points at the ready. Someone quickly handed him a shield. The prince took a closer look at the strange monster. On its legs it wore a flexible armor covering, so that its lower body looked to be made of iron. Chest, upper arms, and throat were protected by metal plates with runic decorations. These plates, Malin was shocked to notice, were fastened directly into the creature's skin by means of thick metal wire.
"Stone!" it commanded in a voice as clear as glass, thrusting its hand out toward King Nate.
The fingers clicked open and reflected the lamplight. Like the rest of the creature's forearm, they were covered in metal. Malin saw the countless bolts and thin rivets holding body and armor welded together.
"By Palandiel, is the Evil One reincarnated?" asked Alvaro, appearing at the prince's side and holding a sword he had grabbed from one of the injured guards. "Whatever it is, it should by rights be dead. Do you see what it has on its back?"
Malin took a closer look. It was not a rucksack, but a kind of metal box held in place by six long rods piercing the body. The ends protruded from the creature's chest and were reinforced with crossbeams, so that they were not torn out of the flesh by the sheer weight of the metal. No living being could withstand such torture.
"Stone!"
it repeated forcefully, stepping forward. An iron shoe landed with a crash on the flagstone, cracking it in half. The runes glowed an intimidating green, all except one. Malin would not otherwise have noticed it, but it was very different in appearance from the others, namely, elfish.
"What are you?"
asked King Nate, who continued steadfastly to hold the gemstone concealed in his hand.
"What do you want with the stone?"
Malin turned round to Regalian, who had remained out on the dance floor, white-faced as a corpse, staring at the monster. He could read recognition in her eyes.
"What can this mean?" he thought.
Then the monstrosity sprang. Without noticeable effort, it jumped over the row of soldiers and landed next to the king. The marble cracked noisily where it came down. Before anyone could act, it had grabbed hold of the monarch, tearing the diamond out of his hands and taking three of Nate's fingers with it. He screamed and sank to his knees, blood gushing over his hand and staining the costly garments he wore. Alvaro and Malin both attacked at once, one from the right, one from the left. The monster roared and parried Alvaro's blow with its bare hand. The runes on the armor glowed green, and the creature shattered the descending blade as easily as if it had been made of balsa wood. Then it kicked the officer in the chest so hard that he shot against the guards as if from a catapult, knocking three of them flying. Malin was sure at least his own attack would be successful. But his opponent turned with unbelievable speed, so that Malin's blade landed on the armored breastplate. The sword thrust was deflected harmlessly. The response was a flying iron fist. Malin ducked, and the blow shattered his shield rather than his face. He had an idea how a wall might react to the blows of a battering ram. In spite of the weight of his armor, it knocked him over so that he lost his footing and sailed two paces back through the air. He fell heavily against the wall and saw stars dancing before his eyes.
"What are you waiting for?"
he yelled.
"It's taken the stone! Don't let it get away!"
He threw down the useless shield and launched another onslaught. By this time the soldiers had been shaken out of their trance and were pinning their hopes on the superiority of their numbers. The monstrous being thrashed around itself with a captured sword, bringing down one of the men. The rune glow grew stronger, seeming to give the creature immense power. Picking up its victim by one leg, it screamed and hurled him against the attacking guards, who reeled back in horror to avoid the human cudgel. This provided the monster with the gap it needed to dash through and escape. It had what it had come for. The bloody cadaver of the unfortunate guard was dropped, horribly twisted and battered. At the stairway, Alvaro confronted the fleeing creature. Crouched forward in readiness, he brandished his outstretched sword in the direction of the beast.
"The face of an elf, the body of an orc, and the magic runes of Jon Balsur on your armor. What are you?" he demanded to know.
Malin raced after the monster, 5 guards in his wake. He was desperate to retrieve the stone. Alvaro knew he had no chance of vanquishing the beast on his own. He wanted to give his prince time to attack from behind, but the monster had seen through the plan. It glanced back over its shoulder at its pursuers, bared its teeth, threw down its sword, and dashed past Alvaro.
"Halt!"
The officer raised his weapon to strike. The ghastly thing touched him on the head with its left hand. Runes flashed, and a lightning bolt was released, incapacitating everyone in the room with the dazzling light. When Malin could see again, it was clear that the intruder had disappeared. Rogelian was kneeling next to Alvaro, cradling his head. Blood gushed from his throat in a stream impossible to staunch. The guards bolted up the steps to look outside for the escaped monster, while Malin dropped on his haunches by the side of his mortally wounded comrade.
"No, my friend, do not let your soul depart."
He pulled off the false gnome mask, took the man's hand in his own, and pressed it hard. He tried to hide the depth of his concern at his friend's condition so that Alvaro would not realize how close he was to death. Hope was essential.
"I beseech you."
Alvaro attempted to speak, his gaze sliding over to the elf maiden, but he was coughing blood and his croaking voice could not be understood. Finally, his body fell back and his eyes relinquished all signs of life. Tears flowed down Malin's cheeks. He was not ashamed to weep. He had lost a man at whose side he had ridden and fought through countless battles against enormous odds, and yet they had always survived. What no orc sword had ever achieved, this monster had brought about with a single touch of the hand.
"There. You see what has come of your longing for combat," he murmured, as he gently closed the dead man's eyelids. "You shall not be forgotten. Your death shall not stay unavenged."
He nodded over to Rogelian, who was watching him, compassion in her gaze.
"Is it true, what he said?"
"What do you mean, Prince Malin?"
She carefully laid the officer's head back on the ground, dismayed at the sight of the blood sticking to her fingers. Malin thought this must be the first time in her sheltered existence that she had been confronted with violent and brutal death in such a way. She had lived among art and poetry, not warfare. Alvaro recognized the runes on the armor as being of Alfar origin. "I too found them familiar in some way. They were similar to those I saw on enemy armor at Parista."
"What can you tell me?"
The elf maiden avoided his eyes. Malin let go of the dead man's hand.
"Did I see elf runes on the armor?"
"You are mistaken."
Contrary to all rules of respect and courtly conduct, he took fast hold of her arm and gently forced her to look him in the eyes.
"Rogelian, what do you know?"
"Nothing,"
she said harshly, pulling free. "I was too far away to be able to recognize anything about the creature."
"You were lying. Your eyes..."
"You dare to accuse me, Rogelian of Alandur, of speaking an untruth?"
She sprang to her feet.
"I should have known better. You are an uncultured yokel, no better than any other human I have ever met," she said with disdain. "I fear your realm must undergo intense scrutiny before it can be judged worthy to receive the gifts of our knowledge."
It seemed to Malin that a mask concealing the elf's real nature had fallen from her countenance. Her anger revealed her true attitude toward himself and his kind. The admiration he had been feeling for her started to ebb away.
"One of the diamonds has been stolen, but this is all you can think of now?"
"It is one of 14.
"It is the second of 14,
Malin corrected, standing up.
"Rogelian, you will tell me what you..."
Rogelian turned on her heel and went over to King Nate. The prince started to follow her, but was prevented by the 2 guests dressed as orcs.
"Rogelian has no wish to continue speaking to you, Prince Malin of Eiderslain,"
came the voice from behind the papier-mâché. The man lifted his hand to remove the mask. The face underneath was that of an elf. It bore a smile, but a cool one. She prefers to attend to the care of her host, and to see what the elf's knowledge of healing can do to aid him.
This is knowledge which you have yet to earn. Go and seek the diamond, said the other elf, slipping in his turn out of his disguise. We shall inform you when Rejalin wishes to speak to you about what has occurred.
Malin pushed them to one side, but they overtook him and barred his way. He stopped short and was about to raise his sword arm in earnest when he recalled the words spoken so recently by the king.
Harmony. The peoples united.
Tell Rejalin that I expect an explanation, and that I shall inform all the other royal houses of Gerdlegard about this event, and the strange attitude an elf woman displayed. If she won't speak to me, she will have to account for herself when her own ruler, Prince Lutacil of Alandor, commands it.
Certainly, Prince Malin. The elf on the right nodded superciliously. We shall pass on your words.
Malin sheathed his sword, called some of his soldiers, and gave the order for them to carry the body of his friend out of the ballroom. As they laid him on a stretcher and bore him away up the steps, a thought occurred. Alvaro had been touched on the head by the monster's hand, not on the neck, where the deadly wound had been. While all were blinded by the flash, no one had been near him. No one save the elf woman. An incredible idea came to him. Malin stopped on the dais and turned to Rejalin, who was attending to the king. Was she exacting revenge for his insults, he wondered? Or was Alvaro too close to the truth in what he said today at the feast? The unique beauty of the elf woman had disappeared completely. From now on, Malin resolved to treat her with the strongest suspicion. Her, and all other elves.
Chapter 3 Gerdlegard, the mountains of the Grey Range on the northern border of the Fifthling Kingdom. Spring, 6241st solar cycle. Tungdil and Boindil were in one of Gandagar's own chambers waiting impatiently for the High King to arrive. The dust of the outer lands was still chafing their skin and clinging to their beards. But nothing, not even the glimpse of a water trough, had kept them from the opportunity of an immediate meeting. There was simply too much to discuss.
"Did you see how she wept when we handed over her son's helmet?" asked Boindil, filling a jug with water.
For once he felt like quenching his thirst with water rather than beer, unlike Tungdil, who had already downed a tankard of the black stuff.
"It was better to let her assume that her son is dead," insisted Tungdil.
"But you said yourself that he might well be alive, and that you didn't trust those obvious signs."
"Better to find her son within the cycle and bring him back to her than to leave her in this uncertainty."
Ireheart was silent.
"And what do you think that figure was, and the strange thing behind it?"
"Maybe a gnome in disguise," said Tungdil, gulping down a draught. "Or a dwarf?"
"Or an undergroundling?"
Tungdil had asked himself this question countless times on the way back from the stone gateway. The fact was that they had found indecipherable runes on the tunnel walls. He and Boindil had assumed they were of dwarf origin because of the perfection of the craft used in their execution. It was also a known fact that old records and drawings described a race related to their own on the other side of the mountain chain encircling Gerdlegard. It was they who had forged a first keenfire, so they must have loved working with red-hot metal and have been experts in the smithy. But regrettably, it seemed that not a soul had ever seen one of them face to face.
"I just don't know," admitted Tungdil honestly. "But if it was one of those dwarves, then we know now that they don't like us."
The warrior's brow furrowed, his expression thunderous.
"You think they're after our treasure?"
He put the beaker down and ran his finger along the edge of his spurred axe.
"Just let them try,"
he growled aggressively. "Let us see why Gundagar wanted us back here so swiftly," Tungdil said to calm him. "The messenger we found at the gate, he must have been sent out after us just after we left."
"It can't be anything terrible," said the warrior twin, "or the guards at the gates would have been on high alert."
The door opened to admit Gundagar. Three elves followed him, completely out of place here in their fine raiment, garments of delicate fabrics in the lightest of colours. In Tungdil's view, their robes alone were disturbing enough, contrasting with the muted browns and subdued tones that the children of the smith preferred to wear. But really, he thought, it wasn't just their apparel. It was the elves themselves he didn't like. Not elves in general, he had nothing against them in principle. Their way of life, from their buildings to their clothing and their language, it all formed an organic whole in Alandur. But here, their very presence struck a discordant note, like a shrill soprano singing out high above the mellow harmonies of a dwarf voice choir. Judging from the expression on Boindil's face, he was of a like mind.
"It is something terrible," he murmured, half in earnest, half in jest. "It's delicate little elves."
"So the heroes have returned," Gundagar greeted them warmly, shaking hands. "Were you pleased to find your old friend, Tungdil?"
"Your little surprise worked well, Your Majesty," Tungdil smiled. Gundagar took a step to one side.
"These are Eldror, Eredosil, and Antimar. A delegation from the elf ruler Prince Lutosil. Not messengers, but ambassadors, to initiate cooperation between our hitherto hostile peoples."
He presented the two dwarves. The elves bowed to Tungdil and Ironheart. This gesture of respect would not have been so sincere 10 cycles before, if indeed it would have been made at all. They had been warned about the likely state of Tungdil, otherwise the elf faces might have betrayed natural feelings of disgust. Boindil could not help himself.
"Well, knock me down with a shovelful of coals," he laughed out loud.
And he nearly said pointy ears.
"Elves and dwarfs living under one roof?"
He dug Tungdil in the ribs.
"What you say to that, eh, scholar?"
Endror joined in with the laughter.
"It may seem strange to you, Boindil Doubleblade, but our ruler considers it was high time this came about. He needed to wait until he had persuaded the last of the doubters in our ranks of the great benefits of close cooperation."
He looked around.
"I wouldn't go so far as to say we were moving in permanently. We shall be staying here for the next 100 orbits, as we shall do in all the dwarven kingdoms, to learn more about their land and culture."
"Sounds like spying to me," said Ironheart.
"You want our formulae for iron and steel smelting, don't you?"
He winked at Tungdil.
"No, on the contrary. We want to share our knowledge with you. We are not looking for recompense, but I'm sure that your people..."
Here Eldror turned to Gundagar.
"Will reward us for our generosity. By this I do not mean with gifts of monetary value, but with the knowledge and rich experience of your forefathers."
"So, not spies, but blackmailers," mouthed Boindil.
He was enjoying himself.
"Even if their speech is flowery."
Tungdil answered. "At long last, Gerdlegard is uniting." He licked his dry lips, wanting his next beer.
"It seems exactly the right time, because we have something to report from our excursion into the Outer Lands."
The elves exchanged glances.
"The High King has already intimated something. You have shown courage again, Tungdil Goldhand,"
Eldror said, according him respect.
"I asked him to," said Gundagar, inviting them over to partake of the modest refreshments on the table in the middle of the room.
The word modest, in connection with dwarven cuisine, is always to be interpreted generously, as is familiar from their classic dishes. The elves appreciated the simmered mushrooms, but their palates were offended when it came to the strongly spiced cheese or the dessert prepared from the intestines of guggle larvae. Tungdil was particularly cheered by the sight of a small barrel of black beer.
"We acquire the beetles from the feeling markets in the south, and we process them here ourselves," explained the High King proudly. He had not noticed the faces of his elven guests, who were trying their best to appear hungry. Gandagar helped himself to the white cream.
"If, for nothing else, you have proved invaluable in opening up trade for us in this way," he said to Tungdil, who was also tucking in, careful, however, to avoid those dishes that reminded him too acutely of time spent in the city of the Freelings, and with Mir.
"A dwarf woman had asked us to look out for her son, Gremdulin," said Tungdil, downing the next two tankards as he launched into his report on their trip to the Outer Lands. Iarhart had to signal to him that his speech was getting slurred.
"We found piles of orc bones in a cave. The monsters had been slaughtered by the hundred, it seems. We were just about to investigate further when a dwarf we didn't know turned up and somehow brought the whole cave crashing down around us. He was working with the weirdest machine. Never seen the like."
He gestured with his arms to indicate the dimensions.
"When we'd escaped the rockfall, we headed straight back out to the gate," he said, hurriedly ending his report.
He just managed to suppress a huge belch, disguising it as a long exhalation, but it was enough to shatter the equilibrium of the elves.
"I'll wager they regret they ever came," whispered Boindil merrily. "Look, their pointy ears are drooping. Maybe I can cheer them up with the one about the dwarf and the orc."
Gandagar ignored the crude behavior of his heroes.
"It sounds as if we have a completely new danger to contend with," he said, concerned, addressing them all. "Do your people know about these machines Tungdil is describing?"
Eldror hesitated, his brown gaze fixed on Tungdil's empty tankard.
"Forgive me if I speak bluntly, but can we really believe him? Is there not a possibility he may be exaggerating?"
He glanced at Iarhart.
"Is that exactly how it was, Boindil Doubleblade? Or did you both perhaps succumb to your thirst on the way?"
Had it been spoken before the death of his brother, the politely voiced insult would have brought Boindil vaulting over the table to grab the elf by the ears, using one hand to dunk the scoundrel's face in the soup, while he wielded his axe in the other to cut him into tiny slices. But nowadays, his combat fury was stilled, and the curse was broken that made his blood boil.
"I would say only this, friend elf. Even if a dwarf is too drunk to tie his shoelaces, he will never, ever tell a lie."
And his laughter was as sharp-edged as the blade of an axe. Eldror realized his mistake and bowed in apology.
"Forgive me, Tungdil Goldhand."
Tungdil waved his hand dismissively. Even if he remained calm on the surface, the words of the elf were eating into him. He had reached the point where his reports were not being believed. He looked down at himself, noting the belly, the bits of food he had dropped, and the dirt on the chainmail shirt that now fitted him as tightly as a sausage skin. His eye fell on the empty tankards.
"What has become of me?"
he asked himself in desperation and disgust, and then reached out for the next beer.
"No, I have never heard of any machinery like that, High King Gandagar," said Eldror. "Were there not some rumours once of a dwarf people known as the Undergroundlings, perhaps?"
The door opened, and a messenger hurried in, drenched in sweat.
"Excuse my bursting in, sire. My name is Beldebin Anvilstan from the Clan of the Steely Nails."
He made a bow to the High King.
I am sent by Queen Zamtes II with this message for you, King Gandagar, he said, out of breath. You must read it at once. There are terrible things happening in the Red Mountain Range.
The leather wallet changed hands, and Gandagar broke the seal. He quickly read the lines and raised his eyes from the paper.
My friends, here we have the answer to our riddle.
He read the letter out.
Honored Majesty, High King Gandagar, I fear we have underestimated the tenacity of our enemies. After more than 5 cycles of quiet, they have again set out to bring death and renew destruction to our peoples with methods previously unknown. I have already lost 54 good workers and 10 of my warriors to an uncanny machine that travels through our tunnels, attacking anything in its path. It has teeth, tongs, blades, and other deadly weaponry with which it hacks and stabs. I have enclosed a drawing, in case your people, or perhaps the fifthlings with whom you are staying currently, were to come across such a machine. It is subverting any attempt on our part to repair the tunnel network, because no one dares enter the galleries. I understand the fear only too well. So far we have found nothing with which to combat this malign contraption, as it gives no warning when or where it may strike. We are not able to defend ourselves or prepare for its attacks. Traps we have tried have proved ineffective. We know nothing about it, only that it is immensely strong and heavy. It is partly steam-powered. I assume it is of a similar construction to the hoists we use to lift the wagons onto the rails, but it is smaller, and it is mobile. The runes on the armor plating make it clear that a thirdling force is behind it. Beaten, yet not destroyed, we bring destruction. I do not want the entire thirdling community blamed for the actions of an individual or of an ignorant and malicious minority, but they must all be interrogated to find out who is capable of constructing something like this. I have sent warnings to all the other dwarf realms, because I do not know if the danger is targeted solely on us, or whether, fracas help us, there are similar machines elsewhere. The dwarf assembly must be called, so that we can decide on action. May Vrakas bless you and keep you, High King Gandagar.
Queen Zamtes, Stubborn Streak, of the Clan of the Stubborn Streaks, in the Firstling Kingdom of Borongar's folk.
There we are. That's the explanation. That figure in the tunnel was a thirdling,
Ironheart exclaimed, slamming his hand down so hard that the spoons rattled.
We must have discovered their base in the Outer Lands.
Tungdil took a deep breath. He was not feeling well. He had swigged that beer far too quickly.
Why would they bother to dig to the outside and send their machines from the Outer Lands into our tunnels?
He objected, mumbling and burping.
To advance unhindered, much less likely to be disturbed than coming over land from somewhere in the Outer Lands, said Gandagar,
agreeing with the dwarf twin.
It would explain why they were making the tunnels collapse behind them, like you said, Eldra chipped in. They want to be sure they're not found.
He continued the line of thought pursued by the previous speakers.
I think they must be based in the Outer Lands just on the other side of the border. They're sending the machines in from there.
Gandagar put the letter down on the table.
Zamtes is right. I'll call an assembly. All the dwarf folks, and the freelings too, must decide on what to do. We'll have to send a force out through the northern pass to find this fiendish workshop. We've seen one at least of these evil bastards, said Boindil, clenching his fist in anger. If only we had been quicker, who knows? Perhaps we could have put a swift end to all this horror.
Tungdil was no longer in any condition to follow what was being said. The room was going round and his stomach was rebelling.
I must go,
he mumbled, getting up and swaying off toward the door. Boindil sprang to his aid in case he fell.
Leave me alone,
Tungdil pushed his friend away. I can manage. He stumbled off through the door and disappeared. Ironheart watched in distress. He hardly recognized the good friend Tungdil once had been. Sighing deeply, he returned to the table to face the disapproving elves and Gandogar's anger.
It's a fever he picked up on the journey, he said in excuse. It's affecting his mind.
Irdisil smiled. His light grey eyes said he believed not a single word, yet he did not confront the lie, wanting to spare Boindil's feelings. A dwarf did not tell lies.
This is how we shall proceed, said the High King. A summons will go out this very day to all the dwarves.
He turned to the elves.
You are also welcome to attend our assembly.
Boindil was about to object. He thought better of it and put some food in his mouth instead. He did not like the open manner Gandagai used with the elves. Letting the pointy ears see their customs and way of life was one thing, but to admit them to their innermost decision-making circle was a step too far, he thought. Then it occurred to him that the arrangement went both ways.
So, who will be going to Alandor, Your Majesty?
He asked innocently, looking at Eldror.
I don't understand, Gandagar was irritated. What do you mean? Our return visit? Our elf friends are all out visiting at the moment, if I've got it right, he expanded. They are bound to expect the children of the smith to send a delegation to Alandor to pay our respects in turn.
Eldror's smile came out crooked.
Prince Lutisil will not be insisting the visit be reciprocated, Boindil Doubleblade. He is aware of the discomfort you face if you have to spend time under the open sky or in forests.
Ironheart folded his arms over his long black beard.
Not so fast, friend elf. If you can cope with spending time underground, we can certainly manage to do the reverse. I'm not afraid of any tree.
Gandagar grinned.
A good idea, Boindil. Why don't you take on that responsibility? Me?
That was hardly the outcome the dwarf twin had been expecting.
I think it's better if I stay here, High King Gandagar. If we're off to the Outer Lands, you will have need of me. Of course, there was never any doubt about that. But it will be some time before all the dwarf clan delegates arrive, said Gandagar unwaveringly. Alandor is not far away, so I suggest you pay a courtesy visit to the realm of the elves. What more suitable ambassador than one of our greatest heroes? Your Majesty, I...
Boindil attempted to change his sovereign's mind. He and Eldror were looking equally unhappy about this.
No more objections, Boindil, Gandagar said amicably. It's settled. You shall leave at daybreak with gifts for Lord Lutisil to thank him for his efforts to further understanding between our peoples. I shall send for you when our assembly reaches consensus, and we are ready to set off for the Outer Lands.
He stood up and nodded to the elves.
Eldror, if you'd be good enough to compose a document in your own language, explaining my ambassador's mission and stating that he bears with him the most cordial greetings of the High King of the Dwarfs.
Certainly, Most High Majesty.
The elf bowed as Gandagar withdrew, leaving Boindil and the other guests to their meal. Eldror considered the warrior's bearded face. Ironheart was picking reluctantly at his food.
You are cursing yourself, aren't you? He remarked, hitting the nail on the head.
No, retorted Ironheart, chewing on a piece of mushroom. I could hit myself in the face, though. With this weapon, he said, pointing at the crow's beak at his side.
The elves laughed. It was a soft, melodious sound, more a refined, tinkling chorus than merry, heartfelt laughter. False as gnome gold.
You will certainly be something of a novelty for Alandor, predicted Eldror, sounding anything but pleased.
That's a letter you're writing for me to take. Why don't you tell your prince to send me straight home again?
Ironheart requested grimly.
"Are you maybe not as tough as you were telling us?"
joked Irdacil.
"What wouldn't I give to be going in your place?"
"No chance."
Ironheart gave him a disdainful glance, then looked back down at his plate.
"You're far too tall for a dwarf," he muttered, shoving the plate away and getting up.
"I didn't mean I wished to go as a dwarf. I meant..."
"So, you don't fancy being a dwarf, eh?"
He looked out from under beetling black brows, laying hold of the handle of his weapon.
"You got something against my race? Come right out and say it, my friend."
No, no, not at all," protested Irdacil. "What I was trying to say..."
Eldra laughed.
"He's taking a rise out of you, Irdacil. He's joking, can't you see?"
Boindil was grinning.
"Took his time, didn't he?"
He sauntered off toward the door, crow's beak hammer harmlessly shouldered.
"Have you heard the one about the orc who stopped to ask a dwarf the way?"
The three elves shook their heads.
"Then it's high time the forests were told some proper jokes."
He winked and left them. Antimar, who so far had said nothing, looked at Eldror.
"Stupid mess."
"I know."
Eldror was annoyed.
"But what should we have done?"
"Just now? Nothing."
Antimar regarded the others in turn.
"But now you can compose a suitable letter for him to take with him."
Eldror had noted the particular stress on the word suitable. That was enough. On the way to his room, Tungdil had got lost a few times. Eventually, someone showed him to a bed. He had not the slightest idea where he was, but his drinking instinct immediately found the bottle of brandy on the shelf. However much his stomach was protesting, he stood up and groped for the bottle, greedily pulling out the cork and taking a long swig. The sharp liquor was hardly down his throat before he was sick. The food he had eaten came up again and again, and the pot he had grabbed in his haste could not hold it all. He spluttered, gasping for air. Then he caught sight of his image in the large silver mirror. He saw himself in his full, piteous glory, a bottle in one hand, a chamber pot in the other, beard and chainmail dripping with vomit, his body gross, and his whole appearance utterly neglected. A fine figure of a hero now, indeed. Tungdil sank down on his knees. He could not take his eyes off the mirror, which showed him his own reflection in such merciless clarity.
"No!"
he whispered, hurling the brandy at the polished silver. The glass bottle shattered, sending a film of alcohol all over his own image. That ugly Tungdil was still staring at him with red eyes.
"No!"
he yelled, throwing the pot but missing the mirror. He held his hands over his eyes.
"Go away!"
he roared and started to weep.
"Go away, murderer! You killed him!"
He sank down onto the flagstones and gave in to grief, sobbing and moaning until sleep took over. He never felt the strong arms lift him and carry him away. Girdlegard, Queendom of Wayern, Mithodania, late spring, 6241st solar cycle. Dressed simply and comfortably, Rodario was sitting on the steps of the caravan, musing over a new play he might put on. He and his troop were on a small island, camped just outside the town proper, which, ever since the earthquake, had been surrounded by Wayern's extensive stretches of water. The small lakes had multiplied, and many citizens had lost all their possessions. Rodario's company had done more of the journey by water or over islands than on terra firma, because relatively little of the Queen's realm of Wayern had escaped the floodwaters. It was a strange sight. It was definitely time for a new, heroic saga. Now the old one about the victory over the Eoil and the Avatars had lost its thrill for him, and the spectators were starting to feel the same way.
"Or maybe a comedy this time," he wondered.
The audiences were demanding more entertainment, more wit and less pathos and slaughter nowadays. Times were good. The people of Gerdlegard were free of cares, and they wanted to laugh at on-the-stage innuendo. In thoughtful mood, he watched Tassia hang out her washing between two of the caravans. The bright sun on her thin linen dress made it almost transparent in places. When she felt his eyes on her, desiring her, she stopped what she was doing, turned, and gave him a wave. He lifted the hand with the quill in greeting. There was no question about it. She would play the main role in his new play, and men would come in droves to the theatre marquee to see her. "Yes, well, the men," he murmured. He was jealously noting how Raymar, one of the workers who helped put up the tents, was handing her a flower. Tassia laughed happily and gave Raymar a kiss on the mouth, and she was letting him put his arm round her waist.
"Tassia! Would you come over here, please?" he called, slightly louder than intended. "And you, Raymar, get off back to your work now."
"At once, master of the word."
She pegged up a cotton bodice to dry, put her hand to Raymar's cheek, and sauntered over, carrying her empty washing basket.
"What can I do for you?"
"I need your advice." He invented something on the spot. In reality, he wanted her away from Raymar's attentions. He held out his notes.
"What do you think?"
She took the sheets of paper and skimmed what he had written.
"Impossible."
"Impossible?" he repeated, horrified, grabbing back the pages.
"But it's impossible to read," she laughed, sitting herself on his lap. "Your handwriting is appalling. You'll have to tell me what it's all about."
She curled a lock of his long, dark brown hair playfully round her finger. Then she grinned.
"It was only an excuse, wasn't it?"
"Just to get you in my arms. Oh, thou most enchanting of Gerdlegard's girls," he said with a false smile, indistinguishable from the genuine article, unless you had known the man for over 10 cycles.
"Not just to drive poor Raymar away," she needled. "He's such a sweetie and so strong, those muscles."
"But no brains at all, and the manners of a pig."
Rodario stroked his beard.
"And I'm far better looking. So, you see, he can't compete at all."
Tassio kissed him on the forehead.
"Sometimes, my dear stage genius, a woman does not need a man with brains and fine manners," she replied, opening her eyes wide and pretending to look innocent. It told him everything.
He stood up abruptly, so she tumbled to the ground.
"So, you're taking your pleasures behind my back?"
"Do as you would be done by, my dear. Same standards for all."
She laughed, lying back in the grass with her hands clasped behind her blonde head.
"I've heard tales about you that would shame a Randy Rabbit. And I've seen those besotted females lining the streets of Mifidania to flutter their lashes at you."
Tassia closed her eyes and turned her beautiful face toward the sun.
"They may be a bit long in the tooth, but they seem to have no objection to a dalliance with the fabulous Rodario."
"Yes, you are right. Women find me desirable."
The actor cleared his throat.
"But since I have met you, Tassia, things have been different."
"Not now," she warned, waving a forefinger in warning. "If I were you, I wouldn't take an oath on that. I'm not blind, deaf, or stupid, and I'm definitely capable of identifying the sound of certain nocturnal activities."
Rodario was starting to perspire, and the spring sunshine was not the cause. His plan of attack was failing miserably. He was heading for a humiliating defeat.
I was practicing my sword play.
"Is that why the caravan was rocking?"
"There were quite a few leaps and lunges to practice."
"And what sword were you using, my darling?"
asked Tassia, as sweet as candy.
"Or perhaps it was a dagger.
Or only a little pocket knife, the same as all the men."
She opened her eyes wide and flashed him a smile.
"Fencing must be so hard,
when you're practicing lines for a woman's part at the same time.
groaning and the occasional husky, "Oh, unbelievable!" Rodario stared at her. He opened